I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia, at thecommentary.ca. Grant Lawrence joins me again. He's just published a new children's book, Adventures in Desolation Sound. He's bringing to younger readers the unforgettable characters and the remote and bucolic part of British Columbia that we've read about in his memoirs, 2010's Adventures in Solitude and 2022's Return to Solitude, and with illustrations by Ginger No. The book is a delight. We see what Desolation Sound was like for young Grant and his sister Heather, probably not as interesting as the television they were addicted to watching in the 1970s and 1980s. And there were the all-too-long car trips and ferry rides that would make them sick, only to arrive to little artificial light, weird neighbors, and no television. But as happened with Grant, in the book, the Grant character learns the magic of Desolation Sound and meets those remarkable, fascinating people like Cougar Nancy and Russell the Hermit. I'll ask Grant about this new picture book and all the adventures depicted therein. I'll ask him about the place itself and what it's meant to him growing up and growing older and to his own kids now. Grant Lawrence is the award-winning writer, musician, and broadcaster. Other than the two previous books I mentioned, he's written two other bestsellers, The Lonely End of the Rink and Dirty Windshields. His first children's picture book, Bailey the Bat and the Tangled Moose, was released in 2021. He is a longtime personality on CBC Music and the lead singer of The Smugglers. He is a Canadian Screen Award winner and the goalie for the Vancouver Flying V's Beer League hockey team. This new book is from Harbor Publishing. We spoke 2 weeks ago. Please welcome back to the Plant Online program, Grant Lawrence. Mr. Lawrence, good morning.
Hello, Joseph. How are you?
Pretty good yourself.
I'm doing well. Thank you very much.
We're talking in the middle of October. Between now and, say, the end of the year, do you get back to Desolation Sound?
Yeah, I do. What I do is mostly we're there in the summertime with my kids now, but I do go up a few more times in the fall to kind of close things up, and then it usually sits with all the hatches battened down for a few months, usually till around March when we go back up again and open the place up for another season.
It's great reading this book because you're bringing these stories of Desolation Sound to younger readers. What was it like for you telling these stories to in a very different way to a different audience? I mean, there is a change, I guess, in the writing, isn't there?
Oh, totally. I mean, one of the biggest learning curves when writing a children's book or transitioning from writing adult books to writing children's books is that the story, the picture, the illustration tells a lot of the story. So, you know, the words you don't have to over-describe anything. You don't even have to describe what people look like. Whereas when you're writing a book, I try to be as descriptive as possible. When, you know, say you're describing the Hermit of Desolation Sound, I would describe him, you know, in the book as look in the adult book as looking something like a cross between Charles Manson and Willie Nelson. But I wouldn't obviously put a Charles Manson reference into a kid's book. That would lead to some awkward conversations, I would say. So, it's the illustrator who does that. The illustrator draws the hermit, and I save on all those words. I don't have to say what he looks like because there he is in the picture. Same with the cougar lady. And so that was definitely a learning curve for me, to not tell so much and just let the illustrations show it. And then, of course, you know, watching the reference points, like, you know, Russell the Hermit was quite an advanced pothead. And in the book, I'm not sure if you've noticed, but there are some very subtle marijuana leaves in one of the illustrations. And I wanted them to be a little more obvious, but they're like, oh, it's a book for kids, you know. The nude potluck was also removed, which was pretty much one of the stories that I've dined out on ever since putting out the first adult book, Adventures in Solitude, you know, almost 15 years ago. And that story was removed from the kids' book because the publisher thought it's actually a little awkward, even though it's still funny. It's still a funny situation. It might be a little awkward in these times to have, you know, naked adults around fully dressed children. And I guess maybe they're right. So the new potluck was cut, but a lot of other stuff was left in.
Yeah, well, there's stuff for them to they can go back to that first book. They can come back to that later. It's something for them to look forward to, right? The children, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so what the realization was that you're writing for kids, and you're also, in a way, writing for the approval of the kids' parents.
Mm.
You're hoping that they'll say, "Oh yeah, yeah, this is a good book. You know, this is appropriate. My kids can relate to this, or I can relate to it." You know, something along those lines. So it's kind of a double-edged sword when writing a kid's book.
How did your father find Desolation Sound?
He was looking for a completely different property. He was in a float plane, and which is the way he often found these little pockets of property. He was a recreational land developer, and from when he was in his 30s, he started doing that. He thought, well, BC is so beautiful, and in the 1970s, there was a lot of old homesteads that had been settled and by colonizers in the late 1800s, early 1900s, that the kids didn't want anymore. You know, there was a migration to cities and towns, and a lot of these outlying properties were, some of them were being foreclosed upon, some of them were being absorbed into parks, and some of them were just sitting, and somebody was paying the property tax, or they were in arrears. So my dad's idea was to go out there and find these old ranches or find these old homesteads and buy them and then subdivide them and sell the subdivisions to people who want just a cabin or a cottage on these properties. And there was a lot of unwanted land in BC back in that era. And so that's what he would look for. And he was on a trip up the coast looking at another piece of property. And he was with this real estate agent and a pilot and himself in a little seaplane. And they flew to the property, and my dad thought it was okay, and then they were flying back, and they flew over this kind of network of inlets and archipelagos and coves and islands and little islets, and my dad said, "What is this down here? What is this area?" And the real estate agent yelled over the roar of the plane, "That is an area called Desolation Sound." And my dad said, "Well, good name for it, because I don't see a single building in sight. There's nothing down there." And there were a couple, but they're easily hidden by the canopy of the trees. And my dad, from the air, thought the area looked so spectacular and so unique that he got it in his head that he had to find property there. Now, at that time, the government was right in the middle of creating the Desolation Sound Marine Park. And in doing so, they were creating the largest marine park on the west coast of Canada. And what the provincial government of the day was doing was they were going to each old homestead, and they were saying, "Hey, to whoever owned it, whatever grandson or whatever, would you sell this? You're not using it. Would you sell it to us? We'll give you market value or whatever. Here's our offer." And a lot of properties, the old Desolation Sound homesteads, they did. They said, "Okay, yeah, sure, we'll take it." And the provincial government couldn't get three properties for whatever reason. And one of them was the property that my dad ended up buying. Mm-hmm. And a few years later, the guy had a change of heart and said, "Actually, you know what, I will sell this to the government." But there had been, just like we're about to experience on Saturday, there was a change in provincial government. The budgets had changed. That offer was no longer on the table. So he put the chunk of land on the market, and my dad just happened to see the ad in the Vancouver Sun newspaper for this coastal area in Desolation Sound. And he called the ad, and it was $150,000 or something like that, and he bought the acreage.
And it's funny reading the book and seeing you and your sister, this is in the early 80s now, you know, you're addicted to television.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
and that... like a lot of kids that are addicted to the screens that they have
exactly.
in there. And Desolation Sound for you and your sister was not something that you were really looking forward to, was it?
No, and, you know, that is something that I wanted to get across to parents of today, is that screen addiction, though it's a major battle today because they're mobile, screen addiction is not a new phenomenon. You know, my sister and I were absolutely addicted to the television. From the moment we got home from school, we'd be watching the reruns, right? The syndication reruns of all these shows, like The Brady Bunch and Bewitched and Gilligan's Island and Three's Company and all these MASH and The Love Boat and everything else that they showed just in rapid succession after school every day. And, you know, it was like binging, the way people binge a series now.
Right.
You could binge, like, six seasons of Little House on the Prairie every day after school because they would play them in order. And you get really into the storylines because a show like Little House on the Prairie would do like a season arc, you know, almost like a soap operatic season arc that is now so popular in television. I mean, like, it was like The Sopranos were one of the first shows that took what soap operas did and put it in a drama. And so, whereas most shows are episodic and the climax happens at 45 minutes. Anyway, I'm off topic, but we love that. Like, my sister and I just loved it. We were so addicted to it. My dad was very, very concerned about that screen addiction, and he dealt with it by dragging us outside into the wilderness and literally as far away from electricity as he possibly could, which was Desolation Sound. And, you know, that still works to this day because there's very little, you know, internet or anything like that in Desolation Sound. And so you can still expunge or at least get your kids to go cold turkey for a bit from their screen use by taking them to these wild places in BC. But, it drove my sister and I crazy at the beginning. We were so addicted that we would, you know, and this is depicted in the one of the illustrations in the book, we would lie on the bunk beds in the dark, no electricity, in this cabin, and we would imagine what was on TV at that time. You know, we'd be like, okay, let's see. Like, but, we, you know, it's like, do you even know what time it is? I'm like, well, you know, if it's 8, I think Magnum P.I. is on. And my sister would say, no, it's like 10. I'm like, oh, my God, that means Fantasy Island is on. And, so, you know, that sort of thing. But then true to my dad's goal, we slowly forgot about the TV.
Yeah.
And we experienced nature, and we experienced real life, as my dad always used to say. And we, you know, sometimes we know now that kids are a little too overprogrammed, and sometimes boredom is a good thing because it can force kids to use their brain to create or to come up with an idea to do something, you know, to go outside. Kids will not just, like, kids will sit like we're sitting at the beginning of the book, my sister and I, just staring at a TV. As long as those shows were going, we would just watch every single one. But if you're outside in nature and left to your own devices, you're going to figure out something to do. You're going to build a fort. You're going to collect shells and make a mosaic of oyster shells. You're going to, your brain, or a kid's brain, will get going on something. You'll explore the tidal pools or whatever. Now, I realize as an opportunity to go outside. And I don't think we're doing enough of it. I mean, we live in a temperate city, and we're not shut in by, you know, 6 feet of snow.
Yeah.
So that's my message to parents these days, is just get them outside.
And to get you guys outside, you know, it probably helped that you got to meet these memorable characters like Russell the Hermit, like Cougar Nancy.
Yeah.
They just seem like larger-than-life people when we read about them in your previous work. When you're a kid and you see these people, like take Cougar Nancy, for example.
Mm-hmm.
When you see her for the first time, what's that like?
Well, that was, you know, scary, quite frankly. I mean, people, you know, we see this in politics now. People that are unfamiliar to you are scary at first, and then you realize that, you know, we're all people, you know, we all have the same basic interests, you know, we all are, you know, most of us, like a vast majority of us are good and have good morals and just want to live our life in a pleasant way and be friends, you know, with other people. Now, when we showed up at the Cougar Lady's property, we were trespassing, so that's number one, strike one. And she did not like trespassers at that time because this was right in the middle of the Back to the Land movement where there were a lot of hippies and mm-hmm. draft dodgers showing up, and she just happened to live in the spot that was the best launching point to get to Desolation Sound. Now, we were not Back to the Landers or hippies. My parents were actually quite conservative, and but you know, these hippies would often, like, they'd trespass across her property, and if they saw a tree heavy with apples, they'd grab a bunch of apples right off her tree, even though it was private. So she was kind of wary of strangers, and we were wary of people that weren't like us from our suburban Vancouver neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was, yeah, and then she had a gun. Like, she, you know, that's the memory that sticks with me, because I was about seven or so the first time I experienced Cougar Nancy, and she had a rifle. Like, I had never seen a big, greasy, black, right, I had seen them in, like, Westerns and stuff, but I had never actually seen a rifle, like the mechanisms and the trigger and the bolt action and the wood stock.
Yeah.
All that was just like, I'm like, oh my God, that's real. That's a real gun. And I knew what guns did. They killed people and they killed things. And she pointed at us, you know, and like, she wasn't like, you know, didn't have it like trained on my forehead or anything like that, but she pointed it in our direction, because this was the 1970s. She was dealing with a ton of trespassers, and she had a few other issues as well, a lot of paranoia. But, you know, my dad had to talk her down. So, but then once that conversation happened and she realized, okay, this is like a family, like two little kids, she became like a grandmother. She became like this friend, this wonderful friend, where sometimes you couldn't get her to stop talking. And, you know, she could grow anything. She could bake anything. She could make anything. She was our shelter from the storm. Back then, it rained way more than it does now. It rained all through the summer. It would rain heavily, heavily rain through the fall. You know, I mean, October was a very, very wet month back, you know, 30, 40, 50 years ago. And we would get there soaking wet, whether we were going to or coming from the cabin. And that was almost like a base camp, you know, where there would be, you know, scones fresh out of the oven waiting, or there'd be warm tea for my parents. And it was an amazing experience. It didn't last because she was an older woman, and she eventually started having a lot of mental problems, and which people back then would call just simply going bush. Like, that was the diagnosis. The real diagnosis was that she very, very sadly had a brain tumor, undiagnosed until it was way too late. And she died at a young age. Like, I think she was really, like, barely into her 70s.
Really?
Yeah, and it was such a shame. But, I think she passed away, like, at the end of the 80s, like 89 or 90. So, you know, just like Russell the Hermit, like, we had a good solid, like, you know, several years of Russell. We had about 10 years, but with the cougar lady, we eventually stopped launching our boat from her property, so we saw her a lot less. Mm. So we had a few great years with her.
The illustrations by Ginger No, they give us such a great sense of what it's like to see this place through a kid's eyes.
Oh, that's a really nice way of putting it.
When you work together, how does it work? I mean, I understand she was familiar with the previous books, but do you talk a lot about what you want to see, say?
I didn't that much. I mean, I wanted her to have artistic freedom, and, you know, they're like the main character, you know, so Ginger Ngo is Chinese, grew up in the Philippines, lives in Vancouver now, and the main character, which is me in the kids' book, I didn't tell her how to draw it, I didn't say anything. I think that character kind of turned out to be what I consider to be a cross between me and Ginger.
Mm.
We kind of look, if you look at our author and illustrator photos at the back, you know, I was a kid that wore glasses when I was little, but I didn't have curly black hair. I had curly sort of brownish blonde hair, but Ginger has dark hair. And so I thought it was interesting, and I never said, oh, change that or change. The only thing I suggested when I was seeing the drawings come through to change was little details, because I'm, you know, because I've grown up in Desolation Sound, I know exactly what a quillback rockfish looks like, which is what we used to catch when we were kids. And she had a drawing of sort of a fish, like you would draw, like if you were challenged to draw a fish, you just draw what looks like a very standard looking, just a fish. Like, but I said, I think we should draw it like it's a quillback rockfish to have that sort of reality in there. And same with the birds, you know, like the mergansers or the loons. I would, if I notice something, I'm like, I think for the flora and fauna, we should try to get it right. You know, we should try to, because there's going to be people up in Desolation Sound that I want them to be able to recognize the flora and the fauna correctly. And so we worked on that. But she was extremely open to all of that. But for the most part, when it comes to the actual storytelling, she just drew. She chose the main images. She chose what to focus on. And, I was very happy to see it all come together, because it's sort of surreal for me to see it. And then the biggest takeaway that I've been noticing with children is when you read a book to a group of kids or like a classroom of kids, these kids, because they read so many kids' books, they assume it's just all make-believe. Like they, you know, it's like the Cat in the Hat or whatever. You know, and then what they are blown away by is that it's true and that the people are real, and it's the last page of the entire book where we actually show pictures of, you know, me with the
photos,
hermit or Cougar Nancy. I didn't expect this, but all the kids' jaws just drop. They cannot believe that it's real and that there are real people and that this is a real place and that and I'm like, oh, I didn't expect that. I just thought, like, you know, at the beginning it says based on a true story. That doesn't really mean anything to them. But the pictures are like, that guy is real? So that's been quite an amazing experience to see that revelation with little kids.
The other thing that comes through is, as I'm reading the book, is the sound. So the music that you would hear, say, on the car trips. You know, on the ferry and the sort. And I guess certain songs, they still evoke memories for you about all those drives to the ferry to and from Desolation Sound, don't they?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, my, like, I still know all that stuff off by heart. Like, we didn't have a lot of music in the car. Mm-hmm. We had, you know, Raffi, the children's entertainer. We had ABBA. We had Billy Joel's Glass Houses, and which is such an incredible album. And we had the Beach Boys' Endless Summer, which is like their massive hit comeback greatest hits collection that came out in the mid-70s. And it's very good. It's just excellent. And it's about, I don't know, 30 songs.
Mm-hmm.
We had a Buddy Holly compilation, kind of greatest hits, too, that we loved. And we would just listen to these. This was our soundtrack, like going up there, the Beach Boys and Billy Joel. And in fact, I was just in Mexico and there was a karaoke night and somebody was urging me to do it. And I'm like, well, what am I going to do? And what did I do? I did Billy Joel's You May Be Right, because I'm like, well, I know all the lyrics because we would listen to it constantly on those car trips. You know, I could have done Beach Boys, but the harmonies and the notes are way harder to hit.
Mm-hmm.
And Billy Joel just kind of blasted out. So it's that has stuck with me. I mean, it's the sounds and the smells. Mm. You know, the smells like the creosote tar on the dock pilings, the sound of the tires going broom, 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 or thunk, 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 thunk on the dock, the beams of the dock. You know, that and the smell of gasoline,
mm-hmm.
you know, brings me back because all the boats run on gas. And so those all evoke memories of childhood for sure. And all those, you know, and I try to play that music for my kids, and they're into it to a degree, but they're now into their own music. So my daughter's into like the big, female pop stars, like, Olivia Rodrigo, Sabrina Carpenter, Taylor uh-huh. Swift. And my son is fully into punk rock, you know, pop punk, like Green Day and The Hives and rock and roll, like hard rock, like AC/DC, The Ramones, you know, The Clash, stuff like that. So I try to get on the Beach Boys and Billy Joel every once in a while, but it often gets vetoed pretty fast from the back seat.
Well, for your kids, was it a quick, growing up, when they got to Desolation Sound for the first time, was it quick for them to take to the place?
Well, they have grown up in a completely different way. So me and my sister, we went there when we were like, you know, the cabin was pretty much ready to go. I would say we first started going when we were like 6, 7, 8, and then the cabin was sort of ready to go when we were like 9, 10, 11. So we were camping at first, miserable experiences in a canvas, stinky, you know, it just smelled like mildew and old yeah. socks, and it was just rain. And then the cabin was built. So it came along for us sort of, you know, I mean, I was almost getting into my teens when it was fully ready to go, whereas my children have been there since birth.
Mm.
So, like, my son was at the cabin within a month of his life, and my daughter within 6 months of her life. So they have grown up, like, every single summer going there. And so my son has a deep love for it. He's 11 years old. Totally loves it. My daughter, she's almost 9. She's starting to kind of go, because we live there in the summer.
Mm-hmm.
And she would, I think, she'd rather be in the city, I think, already. And I'm expecting that to happen because it happened with me when I turned about 14, 15.
Mm-hmm.
I was saying, like, okay, I don't want to be here anymore. I want to be in the city. I want to form a band. I want to do all these cool things. But it's happening a little younger than I expected it to with my daughter.
Yeah. Grant, it's great talking again. This is a very fine achievement. We'll look forward to the next book, and all the best.
Joe, it's always a pleasure to speak with you. Thanks for everything that you do. Always great to have a conversation with you.
The book is called Adventures in Desolation Sound. It's from Harbor Publishing. Its author, Grant Lawrence, joined me on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plunta.